You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2008, scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey discovered a previously untapped location where an astonishing 22% of the Earth's oil and gas could be recovered. The catch? Well, this oil sits below the ocean floor under the polar ice cap and is nearly impossible to access. But that hasn't stopped many countries and oil companies from fighting for a piece of this potential drilling site. In his latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, Michael T. Clare describes how previously undesirable and even dangerous locations like the Arctic have now become the last hope of feeding the growing demand for natural resources, and the implications of that situation. The book is published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Clare back to our show. Hello.
Hello. I'm so pleased to be with you today.
When most people think of impending resource shortages, they think of oil, but you add to that minerals like copper, rare earth elements like lithium, and even arable land. Are the races for these other resources just as pressing as the one for oil?
Oil, of course, sticks in our mind because everybody uses it every day. But indeed, all these other materials are running out at about the same time. And the one for arable land is going to really count in the future because we need that to grow food for an ever-growing population.
And you write that the current consumption rates of natural resources are the highest in history. As the global population grows and developing nations join the industrialized nations in consuming our natural resources, won't the situation just get worse? Are we near the tipping point on many of these things?
Well, what's certainly happening is that all of the easy supplies of resources are disappearing very rapidly. Things that are close at hand, near to shore, in the case of offshore drilling, mines that can be easily accessed. There are large reserves of many things left, but they're all in very inaccessible areas, hard to reach, deep underground, deep offshore, and getting them will be very difficult, costly, and hazardous.
And according to the International Energy Agency, all but a few large oil fields have already reached their peak output. You say the outlook is similar for all these other raw materials. Which ones are the most crucial?
Oil first. Copper is very important because it's an industrial material used in building and electric wiring and many other uses, and that's in relatively short supply. All the good mines, the good ores, are now run out, so there's a desperate worldwide search for more sources of copper, for example.
What about rare earth elements? In September 2010, China banned their export. This was before most people were aware of rare earth elements or recognized their importance. Are other countries likely to follow suit?
Other countries are trying to produce rare earths. They're not exactly rare, but they don't exist in great concentrations, so it's very hard to separate them from other minerals where they're found. It's very environmentally dangerous. You have to leach them out with acids, and the U.S. has stopped producing them, although we could, if we want to overlook the environmental problems. Indonesia is trying to build a refinery in Malaysia for this purpose, but the Malaysians are rising up and revolt when they realized how dangerous this is going to be. So China may continue to be the main supplier.
But if they're keeping it for themselves, then that means that they will wind up being the only people capable, the only country capable of producing many things like cell phones and computers.
Exactly.
Which rely a lot on rare earth elements.
And particularly hybrid cars. These are important for the motors and other parts of advanced automobile electronics and motors. They want everybody to produce them in China.
So hybrid cars rely on these things that create an environmental problem. We're buying the hybrid cars because we're concerned about environmental problems. Are we just trading one problem for another?
It looks that way. Something else that hybrid and electric cars need a lot of is lithium. Lithium is another element that turns out to be very rare. Only found in a few areas, the largest supply.
Wait, this is nothing like the drug that people take?
It is. It's the same element.
It's a kind of a sodium-based thing.
It's related to salt, and you find it in salt flats, and the largest salt flat in the world is in Bolivia. And all the companies, mining companies, would like to get their hands on that salt supply, that lithium supply. Evo Morales, the president, is very reluctant to let them in. So where are we going to get the lithium for batteries is very questionable.
And you mentioned that agriculture is especially at risk. Is the idea of arable land being a premium commodity a new one?
Well, you know, people have been fighting for land for a very long time. That's why most people came to North America beginning, you know, in the 15th century onward. But there was always more land to develop, the Western U.S., Australia, South America. But now most of the land that can be used for agriculture is already being used for that purpose. And with the spread of cities all over, there's less arable land than before. So there's a race to get control of whatever arable land remains.
And some countries are looking for arable land elsewhere. Saudi Arabia, I understand, because they don't have much themselves. But China, South Korea, India, these are countries with large agricultural production on their own right.
These countries are worried about the future. They're worried that their rising populations will combine with global climate change and water scarcity. Water is another resource that's at risk, that they will not be able to feed their future populations. So they're going to Africa to buy land.
And South America.
South America, Siberia, and the former Soviet Union has a lot of former collective farms that are being bought up by investors.
So outsiders are coming in, I'm assuming Americans as well. Morgan Stanley,
Exactly, yes.
And what's been the response locally? Are people okay with that? Obviously, it must be driving up property costs, but and that's always nice. On the other hand, it probably is pricing farmers out of their own land.
Well, there are governments that support this because they see this way as a way of attracting investment, of attracting new agriculture, high-tech agriculture to their countries, like the government of Ethiopia is doing this. But a lot of the land that's being occupied is claimed to be virgin land, as they put it in quotation marks, virgin land, when in fact it's occupied and has been for centuries, usually by indigenous peoples, herders who come in and out, pastoralists, and they feel that this is their land. And often they have religious attachment to the land. So they're fighting back against this occupation of their territory, and this is leading to bloodshed in many places.
My guest is Michael T. Clare, K-L-A-R-E. His latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. You also point out that the pressure to produce bigger yields per field will increase demand for fertilizer, water, pesticides. In fact, you say that from 2005 to 2008, fuel, fertilizer, and chemicals accounted for 34% of the cost of producing corn in the United States. Is that being felt all over the world?
All over the world. The price of producing food is rising because of the rising price of oil. We don't realize it, but food production now is very much tied to the global supply of petroleum. So right now, with oil prices at very high levels, it means food prices are rising. And this is causing a lot of pain and discontent in many poor parts of the world. And many of us believe that the Arab Spring and other disturbances we're seeing around the world are in part triggered by the hardship that people, poor people, are experiencing when the price of bread doubles or triples in the space of a few weeks or months.
You write, the race we're on today is the last of its kind we're likely to undertake.
Yes.
So, that suggests that we have passed the tipping point.
Oh, yes. I think we've passed the tipping point in the sense that there, after we invade the Arctic and Greenland and a few other places like that, there's nowhere else to go. I mean, unless you believe we're going to go to the moon like Newt Gingrich. I don't believe that. So we better have another plan in store for when this is over.
And the places that you label as the potential gold rush sites for natural resources are often rather remote and harsh. We're talking about parts of Siberia, Mongolia, the Arctic, as well as areas where there is a lot of war in Africa, like Congo and Sudan and Liberia, places that were abandoned by commercial interest groups because of the dangers. So despite the dangers now, have they suddenly become desirable?
Well, what's happened is that everywhere else is no longer an option. You wouldn't go to the Arctic, as Shell Oil is going this summer, to the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea off of Alaska, if you could drill closer to home. It's very expensive. But everywhere closer to home has already been depleted. This is not a matter of choice.
And you begin your book in the Arctic in 2007 when the Russian scientist Artur Chilingarov planted a Russian flag on the seabed of the North Pole. He said any time a country wins something, it installs its flag. Well, first of all, how was it even possible to travel under the North Pole?
Well, this was an effort by the Russians using a mini-submarine, and they traveled 2 miles down, something like that, to the bottom of the ocean under the ice cap that sits on top there. And they were able to plant a titanium flag down there. And this is part of a Russian effort to claim most of the Arctic Ocean as being an extension of Russian territory. And under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, if you could prove that your continental shelf extends, you could claim that for economic exploitation.
But why go through the danger of, and I gather there was only an estimated 30% survival of that, why go through that danger if you can claim the continental shell? Does planting a flag have any legal bearing?
No, the flag was just
a gimmick. Symbolic thing?
That was a symbolic thing to get attention for Russia's claim. But the real purpose of that trip was to get soil samples so that they could show that this is not the North Pole, but it's part of Russian territory.
Aren't there other countries who are arguing that that claim can't be held, can't hold up?
Indeed. The Danes, you don't think of them as an Arctic power, but historically they own Greenland, and Greenland very much is an Arctic power extending, and the Danes claim the North Pole. So does Canada, because Canada also reaches up to that part of the world.
But wouldn't it be very expensive to extract oil 2 miles down underneath the North Pole ice cap?
Well, that's the irony. That's the irony here, that as we burn fossil fuels and emit all this carbon dioxide, it's heating up the atmosphere. It's making the Arctic warmer. The planet is warming in the Arctic faster than anywhere else on the planet, so the ice cap is melting. Many scientists believe it may be gone in another quarter of a century.
So they're banking on the ice cap going?
Yeah, they're banking that they could then drill for more oil, and this, of course, will speed up global warming. It's an insanity, but that's exactly the calculation.
It almost seems like an incentive to not do things to slow down global warming.
Well, one wish that would be the message we'll all take from this.
New ships would have to be developed, new drilling technology. You'd have to train personnel. And then military would get involved?
The military is getting involved because the offshore boundaries, the maritime boundaries in the Arctic are disputed, where Canada, Russia, Denmark, and the United States and Norway meet up at the North Pole. There's no clear definition of the boundaries up there. And now that nobody cared before, obviously, but now that there's a lot of oil and gas up there, they do care, and they're fighting over where the boundaries lie.
And we know for sure that there is oil and gas up there?
We're pretty sure that there is a lot.
And we also can make a claim because of Alaska?
The United States can make a claim because of Alaska. There's famous purchase that people made jokes about in the day, but it now may turn out that the most valuable part is the offshore Alaska.
Michael T. Clare's latest book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guest is Michael T. Clare, the author of 14 books, including Resource Wars and Rising Power Shrinking Planets. He is a contributor to Current History, Foreign Affairs, Los Angeles Times, defense correspondent for The Nation, and director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. His latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Okay, well, the Arctic is a possibility, as scary as it seems. Are there any other places besides the Arctic with promising oil potential?
Well, the most promising other area, there is the deep offshore, where a lot of drilling is taking place. And then there's shale rock, which is being fracked just the way the upstate New York is being fracked for natural gas. And the most promising offshore location is offshore Brazil. The Tupi Field. And that area is very problematic because it's under salt. It's called the pre-salt fields.
Well, that involves fracking too, doesn't it?
No, that's
just regular drilling of the sort that we had in the Gulf, only deeper.
Deeper and more risky because the underground soil is not solid. It's shifting all the time, so the risk of a blowout and leaks is proportionately greater. And right now, just now, there have been leaks off of Brazil from a field owned by Chevron Corporation, and their top management team there has been forced to surrender their passports to the Brazilian government because of possibility of criminal investigation.
But you also point out that in the case of fracking, it actually speeds up the whole process. You point to Pemex's depletion of the Cantarell Reservoir as an example of how rapidly an oil field can be depleted when the oil is extracted by extraordinary means. So does that mean we'll just start producing a lot more oil and depleting it a lot quicker?
Well, in many cases, that is what's happening with the remaining fields, the ones that we talked about earlier, fields currently in production that are declining. You can either keep producing them at an ever slower rate, or you could get a big jolt by using enhanced oil recovery, it's called, like in Pemex. But then once it's gone, it's gone.
And then fracking has been opposed because it can have a harmful effect on the environment. Is that always the case? Can you ever do fracking and not have a negative environmental impact?
The industry claims that it could be done safely. What you have to do is, line the wells with cement so that the poisonous water, when it comes, doesn't leak into underground aquifers. But they're going to be drilling tens of thousands of these wells all over Pennsylvania and New York State. And I don't believe that they're capable of doing 10,000 or 100,000 wells without ever leaking.
And then a listener writes in on our show page, water scarcity was just mentioned. What about the squandering of clean water resources associated with hydrofracking?
Well, that's exactly right, because many of the areas where they want to do this are areas where water is scarce, North Dakota and Montana, and in Canada where they're starting to apply fracking. They want to do this in Poland and China and Argentina. All of these places have water scarcity. So the person who wrote in is absolutely right. We'll be competing for water supplies in order to get energy.
Now, you use one word in the book a number of times, exploit, as in dense rock formations cannot be exploited by traditional drilling methods. Is this an industry term?
Indeed. It's a resource term. We exploit a resource. We extract the mineral or oil wealth for our benefit.
We mentioned a military presence in the Arctic. You also talk about it in other areas that are rich in natural resources. The United States has become particularly active militarily in Nigeria, the Republic of Georgia.
Yes, indeed.
What would we be getting there?
Georgia is important because it is a land bridge between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. And the United States was a major backer of a pipeline, the BTC or Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline in Turkey. This was a pet project of President Clinton, then by President Bush, to get oil from the Caspian region, which can't come out any other way by pipelines. And it goes through Georgia, and it's at risk from all the ethnic violence there.
Is this one of the reasons that Russia has been applying so much pressure to Georgia?
Absolutely. The U.S. and the European Union see Georgia as a main way of transporting energy from the former Soviet Union, from Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, and Turkmenistan to Europe, bypassing Russia. The Russians are furious about this, and I believe that's why they're so intent on retaining control of South Ossetia, which is right along those pipelines where they fought a war in 2008.
Is current international law equipped to handle the land and sea explorations that you're describing in this book?
Not at all. Not at all.
There was the law of the sea that the UN came up with, that treaty in 1982. Could they have envisioned what's happened in the 30 years since?
I don't think so. And a good example, you were talking about where there's a risk of conflict. And a very good example of that is the East China Sea, which is disputed between China and Japan, and which sits on top of a very large reservoir of oil and gas that both countries want to be able to develop. But the boundaries are disputed. China uses one interpretation of the treaty to claim the whole area. Japan uses a different interpretation of the treaty to claim another part of it. And the two are fighting, and they use their navies as an instrument of coercion.
The Chinese talk about the continental shelf extending to this area.
The Japanese
are saying it's within the 200-mile limit.
Exactly.
And nobody's established which one takes precedence. That would also determine how we go about the Arctic, God forbid, if we ever did that.
Exactly. And there is no court. The treaty doesn't—and international law hasn't established some tribunal or court you could go to resolve these disputes and to say, here's the line. So right now it's unresolved. You know, another interesting place is the Falkland Islands, which once had a war. Now they're fighting between the UK and Argentina over offshore oil and gas and the disputed waters between the Falklands and Argentina.
Are these simply national disputes, or do commercial companies get involved as well?
Well, the companies are pushing the governments mm-hmm. to protect their interests. A UK drilling company started last year to drill in waters off of the Falklands that are claimed by the Argentinians. So the company has called on the British to send a naval escorts to protect them.
Now, one of the reasons we have heard that some of the technologies to produce alternatives, fuel alternatives to petroleum, have just been so expensive and inefficient in terms of energy. A caller asks about the efficiency of the energy it will require to extract oil from the harsh locations.
Oh, what a good question. My sense is that with the amount of money it's going to take to develop some of these fields, if we invested that in other energy alternatives, in another 10 years, we wouldn't need all of this oil and natural gas. It's just a matter of distorted priorities.
My guest is Michael T. Clare. His latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, is published by Metropolitan Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, let's talk about biofuels. You write that intensive research is taking place that seeks to develop liquid fuels from material like corn stalks, prairie grass, wood chips. Why is it taking so long to come up with a workable solution?
Well, it's going to take a large-scale investment. The problem, Leonard, is not the science. The science is well-developed. What you need is to convert that laboratory-scale production into full-scale, like refineries that produce, you know, hundreds of thousands of barrels a day. And that's an engineering problem, and that's the part that hasn't been solved because nobody is willing to put up the amount of money needed.
But in talking about creating biofuels from corn, we've been told, among other things, it's driven up the cost of corn, but also the process of making the conversion uses up a lot of energy in itself. So we're defeating – it's a kind of a self-defeating process.
It is. It's only because of our addiction to liquid fuel for automobiles and trucks and buses that we do that. We use one form of energy that's not a liquid to create a biofuel that we could pour into our cars.
And you suggest that developing fuel from hydrogen might be the most promising solution?
Not at the present time.
When George Bush proposed that, people said, well, that can't be done for another 30 years or so.
It's going to take a lot more investment. And that has the same problem, Leonard, that you have to produce the hydrogen and use energy to produce it.
So, well, hydrogen is in abundance on Earth, isn't it?
It doesn't exist as hydrogen. It exists in water.
Mm-hmm.
So you need electricity to separate it out. How do you get the electricity? Well, we burn coal or natural gas.
And then we would be using up more water resources?
Well, not enough to make a difference, but we will be...
That would be going to the oceans, I assume.
Whatever.
A few listeners have been asking about the potential of solar and wind technologies. Do they, in the end, do they hold any really strong promise?
They do indeed, and they will be the energy of the future. But we have to link that to transportation changes. Either we have to rebuild our cars to run on electricity so that you could use solar and wind to generate electricity for our cars, or we have to vastly expand electric-powered buses and trains and trolleys. Then the more solar and wind power we had, the more we could rely on those for transportation. But if we still drive cars powered by gas, wind and solar don't help us.
Well, we got rid of all of our trolleys in New York. We used to have a lot.
Yeah, well, I remember those days. But the time will come when people will say we need to bring them back.
Now, the scenarios you project in your book seem to lead to, I'm quoting, war, widespread starvation, or a massive environmental catastrophe. So are you predicting some kind of doomsday situation?
I'm predicting more a bleak period of a lot of hardship, constant warfare, constant environmental disasters that extends indefinitely into the future unless we move from a paradigm based on constant resource consumption to one based on efficiency, renewables, and alternative sources of energy. That's within our grasp, but we have to make a conscious decision to change our behavior.
Well, we've seen all of these movies and novels about dystopias. To some degree, you're suggesting they may not be science fiction anymore.
No, and I think we're seeing, evidence of the early signs of some of those.
Like?
The war in Darfur, for example, which on one level is an ethnic conflict, but on another level it's being driven by desertification caused by climate change, the disappearance of water, forcing the cattle herders to move into lands that are traditionally agriculture, creating a massive conflict between competing tribes.
Now, right now, Americans are very upset that the cost of a gallon of gas is around $4 or so. How will the increasing prices of extraction and limited availability of natural resources like gas affect the everyday consumer?
They're going to have to pay more for energy permanently.
And they'll blame it on Barack Obama, I hope.
They'll blame it on Barack Obama, yeah. They'll blame it on the companies if they're smart.
I was joking when I said, I hope.
Yeah.
That was because that's become a big political issue today.
Yeah. And it's a complete fraud because the U.S. is drilling everywhere it can pretty much right now, and more drilling is not going to lower the price of oil because the cost of these drilling is so expensive.
Now, Europeans have adjusted to higher petroleum prices because it's taxed so heavily there. But for Americans, that would be a big problem.
It will be. But the Europeans have been doing this for a while, and they've compensated by investing those taxes in a fantastic rail system that connects all of their cities and by better public transit. That's something we're going to have to do in this country. And there have been improvements in public transit, just not enough.
Well, the proposals for high-speed rail by the president have been rejected by a number of governors.
I know this is ideological madness, and it's driven by a hatred of Barack Obama more than anything else and trying to find a way to discredit him, and it's suicidal for our country.
Is there any incentive for companies to pursue the development of alternative energy approaches?
Well, really what's happening is that there are parts of the country, like in California and Silicon Valley, where a lot of investment is going into the alternatives. Google is probably the biggest user of electricity in the country, and they're investing a lot of money in energy alternatives, in wind power and solar power, and in more advanced forms of alternative energy, because they're going to need a lot more electricity. So there is an incentive for that, and I think we will see a lot more innovation coming out, but not from the oil companies. They only want to produce more oil.
So I guess you're sending out a mixed message here. There are good possibilities, potential situations. In fact, you describe them as perhaps even sounding a bit utopian to some, but there's a good chance that we won't take advantage.
We're facing a period of intense struggle. That's what I foresee, between the vested interests and the old energy paradigm of oil, natural gas, and coal. They're not going to let go. And that's what the 2012 election will be about. That will be the driving wedge of this election, between those who want to perpetuate the old energy paradigm and those who are talking about what the future might look like that would be greener, cleaner, safer, and based on alternatives.
Well, much of the Keystone Pipeline relies on petroleum that will be extracted from the shale in Canada. So is Canada okay with destroying its environment to produce this oil?
Alberta is. And you have to think of Alberta as the Texas of Canada. And the Albertans, who make a lot of their state income from production of the tar sands, favor this. The rest of Canada is much more ambivalent about it. But the Albertans are pushing this very heavily, and they want to dump all of that tar sands oil on us in the United States.
And is that easily refined? Because some oil is easier to refine.
First of all,
others.
It's not oil. It's bitumen. It's a degraded form of petroleum that needs a lot of dilutants and solvents to make it even move through the pipeline. It's very corrosive. And the reason it's going to Texas and Louisiana, because those refineries were built to handle Venezuelan crude, which is also very heavy.
On the other hand, Nigeria's crude is really the ideal kind of crude, but there are other problems there, and has led to rebellion and all sorts of other corruption in Nigeria.
Nigeria's up in flames right now because of the bad way in which the profits have been distributed. The people in the Niger Delta see no benefit but environmental destruction.
On that happy note, I thank you very much. Michael T. Clare, K-L-A-R-E, his latest book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. It's published by Metropolitan Books.
Thank you.